Started. Welcome, welcome. It's only been 2 months since I was here last, which is really a short interval for me. Does this feel really loud to you? Okay, Bill's got it. Thank you. Excellent. So I'm extremely happy to be here and certainly to see some familiar faces. Thank you for coming again. What I enjoy doing on these Wednesday mornings is maybe just a little different structure than what Sylvia and Donald do, although it's probably similar. I do like to just talk with each other a little bit to sort of set the tone for our morning by talking maybe a little bit longer than normal before the sitting. And then we'll sit and then we'll talk again. So we can have the beginning works with what we're doing towards the end. So for those of you for whom this is new time at Spirit Rock, if you haven't been here before, or for those of you I haven't met, my name is Heidi Bourne, and it's always a distinct honor and a lot of fun. Such a pleasure to be here and teach. Donald and Sylvia have been my mentors for many years, and when they are out of town, sometimes I get to come and teach when it works in everybody's schedule. So who here is at Spirit Rock for the first time today? Welcome. Will you tell me your name?
Chris.
Thank you. What inspired you to come today?
I had the time.
Isn't it? Perfect. Perfect. How nice. Well, I'm glad you chose to spend some time here. Thanks for coming, Chris. Anybody else? It's a room full of veterans. Well, I'm really glad that you're here. Almost every time that I come here, I am reminded of one of my very first retreats that up the hill many years ago, and in the orientation to the retreat, one of the teachers said very clearly and very directly and with some emphasis, was a welcoming of every single person who was in the room, and he said to us, not only are you welcome here, but every part of you is welcome. No part left out. And it really landed for me because I couldn't remember a time in my life where I came into really any kind of situation, certainly a large public situation, where it was so overtly and directly said, every part of you is welcome here. And when I thought that, when I heard that, I thought, well, if that's what they teach here, I'm in. This is where I'm going to be. So in that spirit, every part of you, every part of me, every part of all of us is welcome here in this time of practice together. And I'll tell you that after this last week of incredible unrest in our country and despair and all of the things that we're probably all feeling, I really thought, how am I going to go teach at Spirit Rock next week? What am I going to talk about and what can I possibly share that would be of benefit? And I remembered Larry Yang is the one who said that, who said every part of you is welcome. And so I'm coming here today with every part of me in all of my own questioning and fear and anxiety and love and outrage, all of the parts that I think that have been continually stirred up in all of us for a very long time, certainly in the last couple of years. And there's this quality of no matter whatness that our practice opens up for us. That quality of training ourselves to over and over again have the courage to turn towards this aspect of ourselves that might be really uncomfortable, but no matter what, can I be present for what is exactly what is happening. 2 years ago, on the night of the election, I was teaching a class in my office in Arcata. And by the way, that's where I live, about 300 miles north of here. I was teaching this class, and it was the eighth in a series of eight classes, and the class begins about 6:30 in the evening. And on election day at about 6:30 in the evening, Pacific time, was when we were all becoming quite aware of what the outcome of the election was going to be. And somebody who's been a friend of mine and somebody who's been coming to my classes for a long time walked in my office, and the look on her face was this look of complete shock and fear. And something in me in that moment shifted. And you know how we can have these experiences where in a moment a hinge turns, a pivot happens, that maybe we can't actually articulate what is happening or where it's going to go, but we know something is different, something has shifted in us. And what shifted in me in that moment, when I was finally able to give it a name, was, it's really true. Anything can happen anytime. I better live my life. And that's actually been extremely informative for me, that in our Buddhist practice, we know everything changes and everything is in the process of change all the time, and we don't know what that's going to be. But it might be Joseph Goldstein who tells a story about talking to one of his teachers. I don't know who said this, but it was, what is a primary teaching? And that primary teaching of anything can happen anytime. So let's be present for our lives and be very deliberate in our decisions and in what we do. So as I was coming up to preparing for this talk and feeling a little bit at a loss for words, I wrote to both Donald and Sylvia, who are out of town, and I said, what would you do? And, you know, this is one of these times that we come together and with people who we trust and love and connect to and feel secure and safe with, and we do ask each other, what would you do? What is the right response here? And so we had a really nice conversation over email about really what would be of benefit for all of us this morning. And we talked about that we'll go back to the refuges and precepts and I want to talk this morning about renunciation, all of the different aspects of letting go, of simplifying and employing restraint, and also this quality of spiritual urgency that requires our attention and requires our real presence. So we'll go in that direction today. And reminded, of course, from the Buddha, Martin Luther King, Gandhi, every other peacemaker who reminds us that hatred never ends through hatred. By non-hate alone does it end. This is an ancient and eternal truth. It's really wonderful to remember these things, because when we get caught and the clench happens and the fear happens, we don't want to get stuck in the ill will that can be stoked from the fear that we might feel. So it's wonderful to go back to these fundamental practices that the Buddha gave us 2,600 years ago as refuges, as supports, as places that we can remind ourselves that we can inhabit and live our lives out of that place. So we're not going to take formal refuges or take formal precepts this morning, but I'm going to talk about them, and then we'll integrate them into our meditation. So in that way, we are going to take them, but integrating them, hearing them in a way that works for you. So we won't be doing recitation out loud. We'll just talk about them. When I think about the refuges, I think about them as reliable places, reliable sources of safety and comfort, place where we utterly feel that we belong as much as possible. When we think about what is a refuge, that's what that is, a place to go that is reliably safe, secure, and as comfortable as we can feel in our own skin. So in our practice, the practice of taking refuge, we take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And we can all approach this from whatever way works best for us. How do you translate and relate to the Buddha for you? For some, it's the historical Buddha. We really place our confidence in the historical Buddha. We take refuge in that place in us that truly knows, that place in us that is utterly good and utterly wise, that place in us that has the capacity to cultivate profound understanding of the nature of our lives and the nature of how things are. Profound understanding, I'm using that as akin to awakening. So we take refuge in that capacity of our hearts, our minds, our actions, everything we do, that we too can cultivate this profound clarity and understanding to cultivate a wise, loving, skillful life. So we trust that in ourselves. We take refuge in the Dharma, the truth of how things are. And this is what we're doing every single time we sit down, is to cultivate this mindful awareness, this kind, loving awareness. What is happening in the body? What is happening in the heart? What is happening in the mind? And how can we cultivate this mind, heart, body, all as one, so we support our own well-being, which then supports the well-being of others. We take refuge in the teachings. That's another way to take refuge in the Dharma, what the Buddha gave us. We trust that. We understand that these teachings, this cultivation of clear seeing, is reliable. It helps us set our course. We take refuge in the Sangha, our community, not just our spiritual communities, but any community to which we belong, that we feel that sense of belonging, that we are a part of, that supports our well-being, that supports this sense of security, reliability. Being in a room together, this is where we want to be on a weekly basis, to connect with each other and reaffirm our practice and know that we're sitting with a group of likely like-minded people. And not to make any one of these refuges bigger or more important than another. They are really essential to each other. They are interdependent. However, Thich Nhat Hanh, great Zen master, says that the next Buddha will be the Sangha. Isn't that great? That we really can rely on each other as the ultimate refuge. Whether we take refuge in the Buddha, in our own capacity to wake up, whether we take refuge in the Dharma, the teachings, the commitment to seeing things clearly, that's, both of those are very important, but ultimately we really need each other in order to stay on track and to be able to do this. Because as we all know, this is hard work. It takes a lot of stick-to-itness, no matter whatness, to keep going. So in these times that are difficult, we remind ourselves about the refuges. And if it's a practice for you, where you sit down in your own practice and recite the refuges because it helps you, because it brings greater stability and clarity, do that. Do it whenever you need it. You don't need to wait for a formal time. You can sit on your cushion and you can have a very simple practice of re-remembering the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. You could picture yourself sitting in this room practicing and bring that into your practice. The precepts. The precepts are beautiful guidelines, and I know that many of us are very familiar with the precepts. These are guidelines for how to live a life of non-harming, skillful, wise, kind life. And they're really beautiful guidelines to come back to in times of difficulty. They hold us, they remind us of our capacity to behave at our best. That's what we want to do. So it's important when you come into this, to the practice of refuges and precepts, that we see them as guidelines, as supports, not as rigid rules, because most of us don't work well with rigid rules. It just, you know, they kind of can crumble a little bit. So we work with them in a way that is approachable to us. So I'll just say them, and I'll pause, and just let them land inside of you. And we'll talk about each one of them briefly. We undertake the training to abstain from harming living beings. This practice of non-killing, I like to think of it as a practice of nurturing life instead of in the negative of don't kill, don't harm living beings. It is so difficult not to cause harm. We cause harm all the time. When we turn the car on, you know, I mean, it's just, you know, you walk on an ant. We have to interpret this in a way that works in our lives, but what does it mean to nurture life, to protect life in the ways that we can? Thich Nhat Hanh, I'll just say again, refer to him again, the way he talks about these precepts is even stronger. Not only do we need to do this for ourselves, but what he says is we need to help other people do it too. This is the Bodhisattva vow, right? To help others. So we are also, the injunction is also to not let others harm living beings. Pretty big, big challenge. But we start where we can start. So we nurture life. The second one is we undertake the training to refrain from taking that which is not given. When we think about what is not given, it's a lot. But let's flip that around. Instead of seeing it as don't steal, what can we offer? How do we offer our presence, our care, all the different forms of generosity that exist that we can give? We give somebody the gift of our smile. We give a hug. We're offering our presence beyond material things. Certainly, we can give material things that make sense for us in our own lives. But this is about noticing the ways that maybe we take things for granted. Or how do we use our time? How is time shared in a conversation? Are we dominating a conversation? Are we afraid to step into a conversation? What do we take for granted? One of the examples that comes to mind for me, a very, very mundane example, is what happens when we're sitting in the dentist's office reading a magazine, and we have some time because we have to wait, so we're reading this magazine, and we get to the end of the article right when the person calls us and it's our turn. Do we tear the last page out of the article so we can read it? Or do we get to that last page of the article and somebody else has done that because they wanted to read it too, and we don't know what happened? So that's a really very everyday example, but we can relate to this. That's why you're chuckling. So, like, what do we take? What would happen if we said to the receptionist, can I borrow this magazine? I'll bring it back later today. I'm just going to sit here after my appointment and for 5 minutes and finish reading that article. How can we expand our views of our actions to understand the ripple effects? So our presence and our effect is one of an offering and not a depletion. I undertake the training to speak in ways that are neither exploitive nor abusive. So this is huge. I know Donald's been talking about wise speech the last couple of weeks, and it's a lifelong practice. How can we be clear and gentle and kind in the language that we use so we don't inadvertently cause harm? Some people use their language to intentionally cause harm, but I think that most of us don't. But we're very much on automatic, which is why we need this practice so we can hit the reset button easily and catch ourselves before we say something that we would later regret. So can our language be clear and gentle, thoughtful? I undertake the training to express my sexuality in ways that are neither exploitive nor abusive. So we've just seen a huge example of this, right, in our country about what happens around sexual expression and the ways it's exploitive and abusive. How is our language integrated in that experience that we all just had? Can we be disciplined about our physical expressions of affection, even when it's well-intended? Not everybody is comfortable with a hug, you know, and some people are easily huggable, or it's an expression of welcoming. But just to be aware of where are people's physical boundaries and what is okay for another, what is okay for us? How do we want to express affection? Just to be aware of it. And we undertake the training to keep our minds clear and unconfused, preventing heedlessness so that we can fulfill these guidelines and commitments. Basically, we undertake this training to take good care of ourselves and each other. And the definition of taking good care is wise speech, is nurturing life, is being generous in the ways we can, expressing ourselves physically in a wise way. And we know that when the Buddha gave us that last precept, it was a time of fermented drink. That's what it was referring to. But we're expanding that out. What does it mean to consume anything in a way that shifts our capacity to behave in a wise way? So aside from alcohol and drugs, food, shopping, the media, all of these ways that we consume, just to be aware of how it's affecting us. And one of the things that we can do regularly and that we're doing right now is remembering to do this. The Pali word for ethical action is sila, S-I-L-A. And to remember our sila. Not, you know, if you have that injunction, it's not remember your sila, because all of a sudden we think, oh my God, I did something wrong, I blew it. It's not that. It's quite the opposite. Remember our sila as a way of reconnecting with our goodness, reminding ourselves that we can recalibrate any time to whatever situation that we're in. How can I be of benefit? How do I bring my ethical practices into right now? And so when we get triggered and we're in a really difficult time and it's everywhere, is it appropriate for us to engage in those angry, outraged conversations? Just ask yourself that. Can you participate in that in a way that doesn't further harm you or anybody else? This is important, how we manage perpetual fear and outrage. Remember our sila. It's really valuable. It really does support us. And there have been times in my life where I've not known what to do, but to go sit down and recite these precepts and remember the refuges, and it resets me. It's like it's recalibrating the compass. It reminds me of my best intentions. Eddie Hillesum was 29 years old when she died in the Holocaust. She was Dutch, and she was a writer. And this is what she said. Ultimately, we have one moral duty: to reclaim large areas of peace in ourselves, more and more peace, and to reflect it towards others. And the more peace there is in us, the more peace there will also be in our troubled world. I love that. One primary moral duty is to cultivate more and more peace in us so we can reflect it out. That's what we're doing. Because there really are ripple effects. What we do really does matter. So we'll sit now, unless there are any questions. Okay. That sense as you come into the sitting, bringing in that feeling of cultivating peace inside of you and how it can be reflected out in waves and ripples. Annie Lamott said, "Lighthouses don't go around the island trying to rescue ships. They just stand there and shine." Finding a comfortable posture where you feel your body is supported, where there's enough space in your torso for the breath to move, allowing the chest and the belly muscles to soften. Let the shoulders down. Let the arms and hands relax. The face, the eyes, even the space behind the eyes, the tongue, letting the body rest, but holding just enough energy up the spine to stay alert and aware. This is this relaxed awareness. Let yourself feel your breath any way that works for you, that's available to you. Feel how the breath supports you in each moment. And when the mind wanders, gently come back. Begin again with gentle persistence. from wherever you are, coming back into your breath. And coming back into your heart, sensing the heart center and imagining breathing in and out of this heart center. And I'll offer you these precepts once again. And imagine dropping them down into your heart and letting them spread out throughout your body. Just let them expand. I undertake the training not to harm living beings, but to nurture life. I undertake the training not to take anything that isn't freely offered and to nurture generosity and offering myself in a way that is beneficial. I undertake the training to avoid using harsh or exploitive speech, but to speak in a way that is clear and kind and helpful and at the right time. Checking in with your body as you do this. I undertake the training to be careful with my sexuality so that I do not cause harm to myself or anyone else. To treat my body and the bodies of others with respect. I undertake the training to keep my mind clear and unconfused so that I can uphold these guidelines. So that I can cultivate this life of warmth and care, wisdom and kindness. And we'll move into this part of our practice together of bringing in those who we're thinking of, those we would like to hold together and offer offer this kindness of our hearts, those who may be going through a difficult time or those who are celebrating joys. We can say their names out loud. You can speak when you're ready, if you'd like. And I'll begin. I'm thinking of the 11 people who were victims in the Tree of Life congregation on Saturday. All of their families and friends, and all of us who are deeply affected by their loss. Joyce Feinberg, Richard Gottfried, Rose Malinger, a Holocaust survivor, Jerry Rabinowitz, Cecil Rosenthal, David Rosenthal, Bernice Simon, Sylvan Simon, Daniel Stein, Melvin Wax, Irving Younger. Who are you thinking of?
Thinking of the people in the caravan that are in Mexico, hoping to make it to our border. And for all those who are crying to help and support and receive them. Protected, at peace.
Here's a poem called One Morning by Rosemary Wattola Trommer. One morning we will wake up and forget to build that wall we've been building, that one between us, the one we've been building for years, perhaps out of some sense of right and boundary, perhaps out of habit. One morning we will wake up and let our empty hands hang empty at our sides. Perhaps they will rise as empty things sometimes do when blown by the wind. Perhaps they simply will not remember how to grasp, how to rage. We'll wake up that morning and we will have misplaced all our theories about why and how and who did what to whom. We will have mislaid all our timelines of when and plans of what, and we will not scramble to write the plans and theories anew. On that morning, not much else will have changed. Whatever is blooming will still bloom. Whatever is wilting will wilt. There will be fields to plow and trains to load and children to feed and work to do. And in every moment, in every action, we will feel the urge to say thank you. We will feel the urge to bow. Would you like to take a break or would you like to dive in? Okay, 5 minutes. Let's take a break. See you in 5 minutes. To say it does me a lot of good to be here with you. It really does. It's really sweet. So for the rest of our time together today, I want to talk about a couple of paramis and another part of practice. But we're going to start by talking about renunciation, and we'll talk a little bit about energy and determination and this sense of urgency, the practice of what's called spiritual urgency that I want to integrate into our talk today. We'll start with Hafiz. The mind is ever a tourist, wanting to touch and buy new things, then throw them into an already full closet. Doesn't it feel like that? You know, and I think about that in terms of the amount of information that is always available and what is happening in our trying to integrate in our lives. How do we use the internet and the amount, just the sheer amount of data that is continually available to us, and how bombarding that can become, or the feeling of what happens if I don't know what happened in the last hour. You know, what freedom to not know what happened in the last hour, because it really isn't going to change, I don't think, what we do. That's my experience. So I've been, over the last bit of time, I've been teaching a series on the paramis, and I find it, like the precepts and like the refuges, or, you know, like all of these teachings, incredibly supportive and nurturing and really great reminders about ways to live in our world and live in this human life. So this practice of renunciation, you know, it can be kind of a funny word, renunciation, and some people can have a little bit of clench, a little bit of reactivity from it, but I just think about it as, what can I let go of? How can I simplify? What do I need and what do I not need? It's a form of generosity. And as I've been thinking about renunciation in general, I'm starting to think that maybe this quality of renunciation is at the heart of everything that we're doing, because it requires a real willingness to constantly come back to seeing things with as clear an eye as possible and letting go of what we want to be there, how we think it should be, to over and over again, how is it actually? I think it's a wonderful way to explore what the Buddha taught as the three poisons of greed, ill will, and delusion or ignorance. And we start seeing when we need to employ restraint how those things come up, how we get connected to one desire after another, and taking more and more in all the time, and how that works in us. And when we live in the times that we're living in and we're continually challenged not to get caught in cycles of deep ill will, right? We're so challenged by this to see how we even need to let go of the things that stoke that in us. What are we exposed to? What can we take in? How does what we're exposed to, what does that engender in us? And confusion and ill, and how does, you know, we talk about ignorance or delusion or confusion, that any way in which the mind is clouded and not able to see clearly is what we think of as that, how I relate to ignorance. So we want to work with this quality of renunciation by understanding that there are technically in the teachings four aspects, four things we want to be aware of that we want to work with to release. Really, if you think about this renunciation practice, as always, we have a death grip on how we think things ought to be. And what we're doing is loosening that up continually, getting as wide a perspective as we can. So the teachings tell us that the first thing that we really want to let go of is our things, material things, stuff, the continual ways in which we're caught in, I need this, I want this. You know exactly what I'm talking about. And as we move into particularly this holiday season of intense consumerism, can we just check with ourselves with it? Because it's so seductive and it's designed to be seductive. So just asking ourselves, what do I need? What do I not need? Or actually trying to get a little deeper than that, which is the visceral feeling that happens before we actually feed a desire. You know what I'm talking about? That's kind of that urge of wanting, the way that we get trapped in that. Can we just notice it? And that's what's so brilliant about our practice, is it asks us to just notice that feeling. That's why mindfulness of the body is so important. Or Vedana, the feeling tone, the second foundation of mindfulness, that piece of pleasant and unpleasant. And we feel the pleasant and we go after it. We feel the unpleasant, we push it away. So with renunciation practice, we're actually trying to just see what is there and let go of what we don't need, let go of what doesn't serve us. As I was preparing this talk, I was thinking, well, there really is only one talk. And I think from now on, I could name every single talk I ever give from now on, struggle is extra. Right? And I know many of us have heard that before, and I found it in my notes, and I thought, it is so true. This is what our practice is to understand the ways that we are struggling and how we don't have to allow. Let me reframe that. Our practice is really figuring out that place where the inevitable forms of difficulty and pain turn into suffering, and how, where is that struggle, that friction that's right in there. So we struggle to get what we want. We struggle when we get what we don't want. We even struggle when we get what we want because the next desire is right there. So struggle is definitely extra. How do we not make things more difficult? And one of the ways is through this practice of restraint and simplifying and letting go. Paying attention then to things. The second, this is going in increasingly difficult order. The second one, people. Now, what I mean by people is really, how do we let go of how we want others to be? Our views and opinions of how they should behave, what we want them to do, because we think if they do this, they'll feel better. I mean, maybe that happens with our partners or those who are really close, who maybe we don't feel that they're taking care of themselves in the way we want them to take care of themselves. But we, you know, we're powerless about that. So can we let go of our need for people to be a certain way? Or relationships. When relationships change, can we allow the space for relationships to change? Perhaps there's a friendship that you've had in your life for 30 years, and we're hanging on to that friendship because it's been in our lives for 30 years, but what's happening inside the friendship actually isn't alive or working for either person because we've changed, because our needs are different, because of so many different things that can happen. Are you with me on this? And that can be so difficult to break the habit of a long-term friendship, to recognize maybe this has run aground. That's painful. That's loss, right? But can we let go of our need for people to be our certain way, our need to control others, when we can barely manage ourselves? This is our practice. The third kind of aspect of renunciation, of course, are our views. Right, we know this from the Metta Sutta. Letting go of fixed views is so critical to developing this kind, wise heart, being able to see the places we're stuck, the things where our opinions, our views are correct, by golly. And this is difficult, right? It's really, really hard. It is the problem with fixed views and opinions is it becomes so concretized in us. And it is a source of greed. It is a source of ill will. And it keeps us in delusion because this is how it needs to be. I know I'm right. So, you know, there's some interesting research. I don't remember the woman's name who wrote a book called Being Wrong. Anybody familiar with this? I can't remember the author's name, but there's apparently, so she did this research, and there's physiological reverberation in our body about being right and being wrong and having these specific views. So when you think just for a moment about what does it feel like to feel right or righteous? Anybody, just what does it feel like in your body? Yeah. Yes.
So hooked on this thought or this belief that it's threatened, it's like somebody's trying to kill you, and it's unusual reaction.
Exactly, because it's threatening. So what is it, can you name a couple feelings in your body when you feel right?
Energized and empowered.
Energized and empowered, yeah. What else?
Relief.
Relief? Yeah.
Fulfilled.
Say it again.
Fulfilled.
Fulfilled. So apparently there's a real endorphin hit that we get that's addicting. You know, we love how endorphins feel when they're flowing in the body. What does it feel like when you're wrong? Call it out.
Stultifying.
Shameful.
Confusing.
Humbling. So here's the thing. When do we learn? When we don't know something, when we are softer, is when there's an opening to learn. But when we are so sure that we're right, there's no space in there. There's no space at all. Suzuki Roshi said, you may know this, in the beginner's mind there are many possibilities, and in the expert's mind there are few. So this is why renouncing our views, being willing to actually look at what they are, that's the first step. And then we move into that place of suspending our loyalty to our own opinions for long enough to actually take in somebody else or something else. The Buddha said, those who cling to their views go about the world annoying others. That's true, isn't it? Oh, I love it when we get a quote from the Buddha that's funny. It's helpful. Yes, you bet. Those who cling to their views go about the world annoying others. And the fourth aspect, this is, like I told you, this is an increasing difficulty, is to be able to let go and get some space around even our fears. This is tough. How do we work with fear and in the ways that it keeps us constricted and unable to move and maybe even paralyzed? How do we use fear, or how is fear, let's rephrase that, how is fear used as a mechanism of control? And we're seeing that widely. And so if we look at how fear is used as a mechanism of control, and now let's track it back by spreading certain views, which may have or may not have any basis in reality, as a way to keep people in a certain frame of reference, to behave in a certain way, and then we go back even more because it feeds our greed and our ill will. So this is something that goes forward and backwards. The necessity to look at how, what is our relationship to our need for things, to people, to views, how does it affect our fears? Where are we in that? And the Buddha taught that what we need to cultivate this quality of fearlessness are our precepts, our sila, our loving kindness, our commitment to living a life that is committed to non-harming. Can we trust enough who we are and how we are that we can have a big enough perspective to listen to another person, that we're not so threatened, biologically threatened by another view? This is hard work. This is our practice. And we understand then all the ways that we struggle to hold on to our views and to hold on to how we want things to be and our things, and even to notice, does my fear keep me safe? The struggle in that is extra. It's hard enough to do this work of letting go. So when we can notice the places we're struggling to intentionally, right in that moment, to use our mindfulness to take a breath and to pause. The other beauty and brilliance of our practice is that it works in the immediate. We don't have to wait until it's a Wednesday morning, or we don't have to wait 4 months until we can go on retreat again. It's right here, right now, the immediacy of the next breath to hold us in our bodies and to feel right where we are helps broaden that perspective. Ajahn Chah said, if you let go a little, you have a little peace, little happiness. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of peace, a lot of happiness. And if you let go completely, you'll have complete peace and happiness. You know, I hear that sometimes and I think, I don't know, is that really possible? I mean, we have to be real about this, because there's a way in which these teachings are so beautiful and so supportive, but our task is to work with them and to integrate them. And when we're not sure if it's actually possible, this is the other teaching from the Buddha. Go find out for yourself. Don't believe me. What's happening for you in your direct experience? So when we question these teachings to say, is this really possible? That's great. We want to do that. We want to say, I got to go find out if this really can work. And that's how the teachings become alive. We don't just hear them as nice ideas, but we actually say, well, how am I going to do that? And we work with it. We work with these practices. And so what do we need in order to work with these practices that sound like nice ideas? We move then into a couple of other paramis that really help us. One is energy, and the other is determination. We bring a certain amount of energy to our practice that says, I know intuitively I am going in a positive direction, that this is wholesome, this is supporting my life, this is really helping me live kindly, where my well-being is supported, where I have more clarity to be able to see suffering and the end of suffering. What when I do it, said the Buddha, will be for my long-term welfare and happiness. We really want to see those places where we are supported and those places where our actions don't support us. And we need a certain amount of energy, a commitment to keep going in this direction. So I want to talk about this aspect of practice that in Zen practice, have you heard the expression, practice as if your hair is on fire? Exactly, right? That's because you've been practicing so hard. You've burned it all up. That's right. So we're careful about what we take literally. Oh, that was great. Thank you. So this idea of practice as if your hair is on fire is keep your energy high. Know that what you're doing is right and good and keep going in that direction. That's important. The Buddha said, better than 100 years lived lazily and lacking in effort is one day lived with vigor and exertion. Better than 100 years lived lazily and lacking in effort is one day lived in vigor and exertion. So that's a really hopeful practice, right? That's again pointing to the immediacy of how effective our practice of pausing and gathering ourselves together and going forward. Yes?
But then how do you balance that with the instruction to relax while meditating?
Exactly. So we're going to get there. So one of the analogies is how do we balance that with relaxing and cultivating this awareness, how much energy do we hold? And so the analogy that he gave us is like a stringed instrument. If you wind the lute, the strings of the lute too tightly, they'll pop. But if you don't wind them enough, you can't get any sound. So this is the practice. This is the practice of figuring out how much we need to create this place of balance. So sometimes when we're sitting in meditation, maybe we're holding too tightly, and we're tense, and it's not helping us, and we can't breathe, and there's no room for the air to go. Or we're so loose that our mind is all over the place, and we're snoring. So really, it's about practice, about finding that place. And we're not always going to have it. Every sit is going to be different. But there's this practice of spiritual urgency that I really love, that I want to bring into us today. Are you familiar with the practice? Have you heard this about spiritual urgency? So this is where we get into the practice of the five daily recollections. And this is where we kind of wake up and come back into the Dharma, the truth of how things are. And the Buddha taught that we should recollect these five recollections, remembrances, every day in our practice. The first one says, I am subject to aging. I have not gone beyond aging. These may become familiar to you now. I am subject to aging. I've not gone beyond aging. Nothing stays the same. Our lives, especially our bodies, how do we relate to our changing body? Whatever age we are at, wherever we are. And we live in a culture that is continually telling us, put this cream on and you won't age, do this and you won't age. But we know fundamentally that's ridiculous, that we are continually aging. We are each of us right here today as young as we will ever be. And great, I don't particularly want to be 16 again. I'm really okay right here with the age that I am. And as much as I see, wow, I probably have 20 really good years, and that can be frightening. And at the same time, it's just how it is. So what is our relationship to our maturity? And can we turn that, just like the precepts, to not look at it from the negative, but actually look at the positive part of it? What can we appreciate about our maturity at whatever level we are at? And to understand as we go through each of these remembrances that the nature of how we are is not a mistake. This is what happens by living a life. The second, I am subject to illness. I've not gone beyond illness. This is obvious, but every time we get sick, we don't think it's obvious. We think, what did I do wrong? And that is not supportive of ourselves to think that we've done something wrong because we got a cold or we got the flu. Maybe I didn't wash my hands enough. Or maybe we have some other kind of illness that is a fatal illness, something that is really a big deal beyond the common cold. But we do go through regular cycles of well-being and illness, and we resist it. Can we not add the struggle to that? Can we add renunciation, the practice of allowing, even to when we're not feeling well, to not be in contention with whatever the conditions of our lives are? That's a renunciation practice. It is not a mistake to get sick. It's just what happens in this body. But we tend to we can be unkind to ourselves about that. We can have a lot of opinions. Or what happens when somebody we love is ill and we have a lot of judgments and opinions about that? Are they taking care of themselves in the way we want them to? This is when we go back to the renunciation practice of, do we let go of our views and people, and this is just how it is. I will grow different, separate from all that I hold dear and appealing to me. I've not gone beyond this. Sometimes we hear this one as, I will be separated from all that I hold dear. But I went back to the texts and I got this translation from Tanisaro Bhikkhu, and I like this phrase of, I will grow different. This says we grow and change, and this is what I meant earlier about sometimes relationships shift and we don't realize that those in the relationship have grown differently and it doesn't work anymore. I will be separated from all that I hold dear and appealing to me. That's true. One of my mom's dogs died yesterday, and we know it's natural and it's painful. It's true. We are going to be separated from everything that we hold dear. And we are not exempt. And we often think, or we operate in some way, as if we are exempt from aging and illness and loss. Whether it's loss of a dog, a dear friend, a job, a home, our money, losing the way we thought our culture was set up. All of these things. And this, coming back into the truth of impermanence is important to understand right in this one too. Everything really does change, and we truly are not exempt from this. Terry Tempest Williams, a brilliant nature writer, in her book The Hour of Land, she says, the mirage we see dancing on the horizon is more than the tease of water. It is the illusion that what you want, you will have. The mirage you see dancing on the horizon is more than the tease of water. It is the illusion that what you want, you will have. We will grow differently. We will be separated from what we love, and we won't get what we want. Letting go again. It's a great story about the brilliant virtuoso Yitzhak Perlman. You're familiar with him, right? And he had polio as a child, and so he's lived by moving on crutches for his life. And there's a story about him playing some beautiful piece in a concert, and in the middle of the concert, one of the violin strings broke, and he paused, sort of reset his body, and continued to play the rest of the piece, and continued to play the rest of the concert with one less string on his violin. And when he was asked about it afterwards, he said, "Sometimes it's the artist's task to find out how much music you can still make with what you have left." Isn't that what we're all doing? In our aging, in our cycles of illness, in our losses. He went on to say, "This has been my vocation, to make music of what remains." This is what we're doing. The fourth remembrance, I am subject to death. I've not gone beyond death. So the big question, right? How do we manage our own mortality? And it's said that our spiritual practice is all about reckoning our own mortality. And so when we come to the end of our lives, that we're okay. That we understand it as natural process, as difficult as it is. How do we manage loss? That's what we're talking about really in this practice today. Another poem from Rosemary Wattola Trommer, who I read to you earlier. This is more like a haiku. Between the tears, a curveball of joy, life takes a victory lap. Between the tears, a curveball of joy, life takes a victory lap. So this says we can hold both. We hold the most difficult tragedies, and we still can eat a fall apple that when you bite into it is the perfection of appleness and crispness. And we can take joy in the ways that we experience joy right inside the heart of tragedy. And it's important to do that. It is important, not in a way at all, to put aside the difficulties. They are real. They are in us. But we also need to balance that with what's also okay. That's what gets us up. And the last of these remembrances, I am the owner of my karma, my actions, heir to my actions, born of actions, related through actions, and have actions as my arbitrator. Whatever I do, for good or for evil, to that will I fall heir. I have not gone beyond this. What I do matters. That's what this says. Everything we do, there's a consequence to every single action, which is why we go all the way back to the precepts and work with these different ways of living a life of kindness and non-harming. So important, because our actions have an impact, and we are the primary recipients of our own actions. So if we are angry and upset and we are projecting it out to others, we might be projecting it out to and onto others because it's so hard to tolerate it in ourselves. But really, we are the primary recipient. It really is going to be right inside our own hearts. And there's one more. We already went through five, but I know there's a sixth that I like. And this is not in the five remembrances, in these five daily recollections, but it is in the texts, and I can't tell you I know exactly where they are, but the Buddha did say this too. I am of the nature to be born. So this is true, to be really aware of the preciousness of this life. And the rareness, he went on to talk about the rareness of that we actually, each of us, has come into this life. But I like to think about this particular one, I am of the nature to be born, is that we have the capacity to pause and begin again. Every single moment we have the presence of mind to not be caught in our reactivity, to not be caught in this extra struggle, and we do pause and we feel it in our bodies and we take a breath. That's how I relate to I am of the nature to be born. I can start over. I can recalibrate. I can say, oh, that was really hard. I'm coming back to my center here. That's our learning. We begin again. And it takes persistence. It takes this determination, this next of the paramis. The paramis, I didn't say, are translated as the perfections of the heart, expressions of the mature heart. So how do we come into this capacity to keep going, this gentle persistence in our practice? It nurtures the energy. It supports our ability to go back to the precepts, to remind us to pause, to take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, this inner knowing. Jennifer Wellwood, the poet, she says, willing to experience aloneness, I discover connection everywhere. Turning to face my fear, I meet the warrior who lives within. That's what we want to connect to, is that capacity to tap into that determination that holds us in our practice. So every time we get stuck, we resolve to begin again. We make life, our whole practice is our life. And when we get scared, when we don't know how we're going to move into the next day and all of our doubts are really big and taking over, the other teaching story that we can use is the story of Mara. You know, I know that a lot of you know the story of Mara. Mara, in the Buddhist folklore, was the trickster, the coyote, the one who kept showing up to tell the Buddha that, why do you want to become awakened? What makes you think you not only have the right to do this, but that you can do this? The one who shows up to say, you don't really want to do this. Come on, just get up off your cushion and go about your day. You don't want to do this. So that's the image of who Mara is. And the story goes that when the Buddha sat down under the Bo tree and said, I'm not getting up until I understand how this mind works, and still until I have woken up, I'm going to sit here, and it's my right to sit here. So the story goes that Mara, that he was assailed with the armies of Mara. And it started out with Mara bringing his beautiful daughters to tempt the Buddha, the sensual desire of temptation. And what the Buddha would say each time one of these temptations came was, Mara, I see you, and I'm not afraid. I'm not so sure about the I'm not afraid part. I really mean that, because I love this teaching of Mara, I see you, when I come up into my own fears and doubts. But sometimes I really am afraid. And sometimes we can say I'm not afraid as, you know, planting a flagpole. But that, I think that's for each of us to figure out where we are with that. We have to be careful how we incorporate these teachings. They're not dogma. These are practices for us to try out. And then it went on, the story goes on to say, then he was assailed with weapons, the weapons of Mara, which were all kinds of, you know, spears and arrows. And the story goes that when the Buddha said, Mara, I see you, and I'm not afraid, all of those, the shrapnel turned to petals and flowers and floated down. So the rest of the story is that they kept getting assailed with these different objects, and the Buddha kept saying, Mara, I see you. And we can do that. This is a really beautiful practice for us to see our own fears, our own doubts. And when we start seeing doubt as doubt, then we start understanding that we can get underneath it and that we can disentangle it. And we just need this determination, this willingness to stick with it, to begin again, to keep showing up over and over again, because you know the people who come to class with you are also showing up. And each one of us needs each other to show up on these Wednesday mornings so we can keep our energy alive, to keep our determination going, so we can say to ourselves, I love you, keep going. I love you, keep going. Last Zen teaching, this phrase that says, when you fall down on the ground, it's the ground that helps you up. It's so Zen, isn't it? But it's great. When you fall down, literally, take it literally. When you fall down on the ground, it's the ground that helps you up. So when we come into these places that we're stuck, use that stuckness to investigate and let it help you up. Let it help you move to that clarity. We don't want to use our doubts and the stuckness to paralyze us, to stay more stuck and to increase the doubts, but we actually want to question, say, well, what's actually happening here? What am I holding on to? So I want to end today with a piece from a piece that Donald sent me the other day when I wrote and said, this is a really tough time. What can I say here? And I was really despairing. It was really in this moment of true despair. And this helped me a lot. And this comes from the Jewish community in Berkeley, Chochmat Halev. You might be familiar. And this is the piece that they sent out to their community over the weekend. Waking up to this morning's news of the tragic and violent attack at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, many of us began our day filled with shock, rage, sadness, and fear. The toxic mixture of xenophobia, white supremacy, unregulated guns, and ignorance claimed 11 more lives. This time, Jewish lives were added to the mounting toll of Muslim lives, Sikh lives, Black lives, Indigenous lives, trans and queer lives, women's lives, and refugees' lives. Christians have been killed at church and students at school. When will it end? As we grapple with how to respond to this latest senseless and lethal attack, let us harness our anger and fear, our grief and frustration into acts of loving resistance. We must resist the wave of hate that is passing through our country. We must be brave in the face of terror. We must remember our blessings even as curses clatter around us. It can feel overwhelming. Where do we even start? Well, we start with ourselves by being loving, kind, honest, and courageous. With each other by being generous, patient, and curious. With our families, by letting kinship and acceptance surpass our differences. With our community, by welcoming the stranger, keeping the doors open, and creating a respectful space. And with the world, by standing up for the poor, the oppressed, and the vulnerable. That's the revolution we can start right here, right now. That's the tribute and memorial we can offer in addition to our prayers and tears, our anger and sorrow. We can become the living embodiment of our truest beliefs. That is resistance. That's how we will make their memory for blessing. And that is how we can change and heal this broken world. Loving acts of resistance. So I want to end there. I know I've talked a lot, but we do have some time to talk with each other. Anything you would like to bring in? Thank you. Elizabeth has the mic. Yeah. Is it not on? There you go.
When you were talking about renunciation and renouncing views and letting go of that feeling of being right, what came into my mind is, what is the distinction between views and values? And are there not values that we need to have and we need to hold on to? And holding on to those values may make me feel that I'm right because I think these things are good values to have. Do I have to let go of the values as well?
No.
Thank you.
It's a huge discussion. And I think it's really valuable. I really appreciate the distinction between views and values. Because I think what we want to do is recognize our views, how they are informed by our values, and how do we live them for ourselves, but not require others to have the same. That's hard. But I agree. We need our values.
It seems that holding on to the values leads me to judge other people's actions as consistent with or not consistent with the values that I hold. And I know from listening to Donald a zillion times over that a judgmental mind is not a good place to be.
But we need
a
compass.
There's a trap there.
But we need a compass, right? We need an internal compass. So I think we have to work with that place where we cultivate wholesomeness, this peace, this value system of the precepts, the value system that says, I commit to not cause harm to myself or others, and being willing to explore what that is. How does do no harm actually work? What does that mean? So if there is a core value of, let's take non-harming, or let's take kindness, or not eating meat, whatever you want to have a view about or a way in which that value system informs your life. How can we live that and not project that onto others? I think that's where the judgmental mind comes in.
It just occurred to me when you were talking that maybe it's enough for me to live by my
that's what
values
I'm saying.
Without requiring that anyone else do the same.
Bingo. Yeah, that's what I was pointing to. Yes. Thank you. Yeah.
Wait, well, when you were after the renunciations, I don't know what you called them, but talking about that we'll lose everything and that
the daily recollections.
The daily recollections. Thank you. And maybe this is a way to think about the difference between values and sort of our opinions, but I was thinking, like, it all just to me was like, it's so easy to forget our humanness, and I guess when our views stop us from seeing another person's humanness, that they didn't have the same history as us, that they might not hold the same things dear, that they might be in pain. I notice with myself that when I forget somebody's humanness, a lot of times it's because I'm clouded by my rightness. And so maybe there's a distinction there between remembering somebody's humanness and still having your value, mm-hmm. and even be able to try to share that with somebody,
yeah.
while not forgetting that they're just as human as you are.
Thank you very much for bringing that in. Because we do. We other, right? We create that otherness and forget each other's humanness. We could do a day long on this, couldn't we? I mean, there's a lot to talk with each other about with this. Thank you. Yes. Tell me your name, please.
I know that this is what Donald's book is about, but you may
put it next to your mouth and tell her
it is.
Name.
It is, isn't it? Is it? Okay.
There you go.
So, if I know my values, hang on to my values, don't force them on anybody else, then it seems like the really tricky part is, as you were talking about, but maybe I have a duty to somehow prevent others from hurting other people. So that's the sticky place.
Totally sticky. And that's from Thich Nhat Hanh that says, not only do we need to, do we need to not harm others, but we need to prevent others from harming. This is where we come into everything that we're saying. Wait a minute. Am I judging other people? Am I projecting my values onto another person? You should behave the way I want you to behave. I think what we're asked to do is be the lighthouse. Is
if I want to be an activist, for example, and I want to say, I want your behavior to change because you are hurting others, this is not okay, then I'm projecting my values onto them.
That's right. And this is the territory we're all navigating. Can we do that with respect? And with kindness, and to recognize our common humanity, and we each operate from a ground of values that have been cultivated from our upbringing, from our cultural conditioning, all of our conditioning develops our values, and then we live out of that and see what works and what doesn't work. And really, ultimately, we can only control or affect ourselves. I don't actually know how that is going to play out, how this plays out with other people. But this is very hard, and what we hope is that the more of us who can watch our minds, can understand how what we do has a ripple effect, how it affects others, how it affects us, that we cultivate more and more wholesomeness so each one of us that lives more and more in a kind, skillful way, that it ripples out. I think that's what we're trying to do. I don't know how we don't really change others. We have to change this. It's a big conversation, isn't it? Thank you. One more, and then we're going to end.
You know, what comes back to me is when I think of, because I grew up in a Republican world, a Republican house, then I became educated, and then the world kind of widened, and I've lived, just totally, and then I become a therapist. But underneath it all, when I think of people, Trump, when I think of what he's doing, he's stoking fear, and the fear of all of us is losing something, losing our position in life, like the patriarchic thing, losing our whiteness and control of life. So when I'm even with my former clients, I think of they come with their own fear. And if I don't acknowledge where they are, I can't help them. So I try when I'm with somebody who's outspoken about Republican views right now, it's to practice equanimity, but also see that they have fear underneath. And that helps me be with people like that.
Yes. Thank you very much. And this is so important when we recognize our humanity, that we all have fear. And that's what we're operating out of. And this is this practice of fearlessness when we have a core practice around a commitment to kindness and non-harming. That helps us manage those fears. So thank you all very much for your kind attention, for your showing up today for all of us. May all beings be peaceful and happy and safe. Have enough to eat, have shelter, be kind to each other, and come to the end of suffering. Before you leave, I have some announcements, and I know I've just gone over. It's just now 12 o'clock, but I do want to tell you some exciting things. On January 20th, Donald and I will be doing a day-long here in which the topic is going to be how do we not make a bad thing worse, basically, around pain and suffering. And that's a Sunday. And on Friday, February 22nd, Sylvia and I will be doing a day long here. And that topic is going to be on wise livelihood and what does it mean to be a leader and how we cultivate that in our lives. And then I also want to tell you about, on the back table, a couple of flyers for my retreats coming up. I know I'm kind of known for doing hiking and wilderness retreats, and there's one that is that, and there's one that is not that. So I'm not just that hiker lady. So there's a retreat that's happening over the spring equinox at Heartwood Mountain Sanctuary, which is 3 hours north of Santa Rosa, just outside of Garberville, out in beautiful, beautiful oak woodlands. And there will be four of us teachers. It's an insight retreat. It will not be 100% silent. Our afternoons, we're going to be doing resiliency work. And the rest of it, the focus is intention, compassion, and joy over the spring equinox. And so there's a flyer back there. And if you are interested in wilderness exploration, I do have a river rafting retreat coming up in May, and the information is back there, and that is also a fantastic experience. So that's it. Thank you for coming. Come to the daylongs. I'll be back January 20th.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.